This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
And I will strike down upon thee with great vengeance. I did not kill my wife, and you don't care. And I believe I can fly, because I'm the king of the world. From the 90s to nothing, I'll be there.
You forgot your thingy.
Place to Be Nation Pop. It's another episode of 90 to Nothing, the only all 90s movies podcast here on the Pop Network. I am, of course, your co-host, Russell Sellers, along with my longtime cohort, Sam Neely.
Russell, at one point we were friends, but now we are frenemies because we disagree on this current movie.
We certainly do. This is
so we had our listeners vote who loves it and who hates it. And I think it was very close, the voting was, last time I checked. But they did ultimately come out correct. I am the one who loves this movie, and you're the one who hates it.
That is absolutely true. The our close friends who voted on the poll definitely skewed it into the right
That's
area.
That's true. And I mean, I voted also just because I wanted to see the results, since you're the one who posted it. And so
yes,
that might have also skewed it.
That's fair. And
the movie, of course, is Empire Records. I guess we...
Yeah,
I forced you to bury the lead there by jumping in.
Yeah, we had to. We need to tell people what movie we're watching. It's 1995's Empire Records, described as a coming-of-age comedy drama film that follows a group of record store employees over the course of one. I'm going to say this term loosely. Exceptional day.
That's right.
And it. It actually has a kind of a who's who of 90 stars and future like superstars, even some major award winners starring in this movie, including Renee Zellweger and Liv Tyler.
It also is the second movie in the 90s in which Anthony LaPaglia and Debbie Mazur play romantic interests with each other. The first being So I Married an Axe Murderer, where Debbie Mazur did feature as LaPaglia's girlfriend in one scene.
And, you know, I completely spaced on that one, but you are absolutely correct. And this is also the second movie that we've talked about here that features Ethan Embry pretty heavily.
That's true. And I like his performance in this one a lot better. But also, because he looks so much younger and he basically is just playing an idiot, it seems to be a better fit for him.
I'll give you the idiot part, but my God, he's one of the most annoying elements in this movie to me. among a plethora of them, but I guess we should get into it by telling the folks, you know, some more of the nuanced plot details of the film, like what kicks all of this off. So, you are a big fan of this movie, so tell the people what is the plot element that kicks all of this story off.
So what kicks the whole story off is Lucas, a pseudo-intellectual, philosophic type guy who is obviously one of those people who thinks he's a lot smarter than he is and talks in such a way that pushes that across, realizes that their independent record store they're working for is about to become a chain called Music Town, which is pretty obviously based on, I think, Virgin Records, based on the way that the font is.
Yeah, I would say so.
So he's closing the store, and he takes the till for the day, jumps on his little moped, and heads on to Atlantic City, where he rolls 7 and manages to end up with 18,000. And he thinks that if he rolls it one more time, he can save the store. And I think he gets snake eyes.
Yep.
He loses all the money. Comes back, and their boss, Joe, is none too happy.
He is really not. And when you think about, like, I guess how far Atlantic City is from where their shop is in Delaware, you have to start suspending your disbelief pretty early.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's a little bit of a drive on a little motorcycle in the middle of the night. And Lucas is definitely the first bit of pretentious nonsense that got on my nerves in this movie.
See, and I loved Lucas, and I still do. Like, I no longer want to be like Lucas, like when I was in my early 20s, but I still like watching him on this movie.
IMDb people can enjoy this, but I think this is one of those movies that maybe it depends on when you watched it the first time.
It could. Tell me your history. When did you watch this first time?
I didn't see this movie until I was 30.
Oh, okay. So I saw it when I was 21.
Yeah, that...
I knew it existed, and I found out, I think in my late 20s, that someone zoomed in on a high-res DVD and determined that the day that it took place was April 8th. Hmm. And it says Saturday, April 8th. And that's another little bit of trivia, for me at least, because April 8th in the year 1995 was a Saturday, and the reason I remember that is because that's the day my baby brother was born.
Oh, okay, so a little bit of personal history there for the Neely brothers.
That's right, he's getting married this summer, so that's how old this movie is.
and
also, it's the day that I, because you know when you're in elementary school, and you go to any restaurant with a self-serve drink machine, you mix all the different flavors together. That's the day, because we were on our way to the hospital to get my brother and my mom, and we went to Taco Bell, and I made the perfect suicide at the machine. And I've never been able to duplicate it in the 24 years since then.
How about that? Like a little, even more reason.
There was some Pepsi and some orange. I remember that much.
Is a soft drinks orange just goes with soft drinks. I stand by this, and it goes really great in the new orange vanilla Coke, which I'm a huge fan of.
I like it. It's really good with spiced rum.
Yes, absolutely. See, we do still agree on some things, but we're just never going to agree on this movie.
Probably not.
April 8th is also designated Rex Manning Day, and
that's right.
Rex Manning is a fictional 80s pop star who factors pretty heavily into the plot of this movie. He'd almost be the kind of MacGuffin, I guess, of the film.
Kind of, yeah. Like, I definitely see him as... I've always seen him... I've always seen him as like David Cassidy. Like, he's a former sitcom star turned pop star.
Yeah, and they feature just one of his songs, like a song written for the movie, very heavily throughout the film.
Say No More.
Yes, and it's catchy, it's annoying, but it's an 80s pop song. I mean, it's an 80s style pop song released in the mid 90s. So you can kind of see that he's that pop idol whose day has passed and never really clear on why they're making such a big thing of him at this store, because he does seem kind of washed up, even by the standards of the day. So
I almost get the impression, and now one thing I do know about the production is some of the cuts to the plot, and I didn't actually, I'm looking on the Wikipedia, they say that there were three characters actually removed in the cuts. But I also know one of the other things that they did when they were cutting and re-editing this movie is that it did not originally take place over one day. It originally took place over 2 days.
And maybe that would have given them enough space to tell some of the story that they were trying to, because you are not given enough time to actually care really about any of these characters to me.
Yeah, if I had to guess, I would say that Mitchell, the character who is the owner of the record store, who's a douchey capitalist, I basically see him as almost like somebody like Stephen Miller. Like, he just seems like he'd be like that, but with hair. He probably said, hey, this guy is going to come to town. He's cheap, but he'll bring in money. Because the only person he sucks up to in the entire movie is Rex Manning.
Very true. Like, he is indeed a piece of trash, but most everybody in this movie is at some point or another.
Oh, yeah.
And that's another thing that I have trouble with in this movie, is like finding anybody to really latch on to. And you would think that even someone who's, I guess he's trying to be lovably dumb, like Mark, of course played by Ethan Embry. He's the stoner kid who works in the record store. I don't know, man. I just could not stand him. I was like, the more he talks, the more I despise him. And
I tell you who I like is, and he does not have enough in this, is Eddie, the guy who works at the pizza place, but then also at the record store.
Yeah, I was a little confused on him.
Makes Mark the brownies.
I was a little confused on him at first because I was like, okay, does he work in the record store or does he work somewhere else? Because he's there and then he disappears and I see him pop up over at this pizza place randomly. I'm like, okay. So I guess he's working both places. But
yeah, he works two jobs.
But is also a stoner almost on the level of Mark.
He is, but he's more like the way that he's definitely more there, but then he's also, like, he actually kind of reminds me of somebody that I know, just in terms of his mannerisms. Like, he'll go out of his way to do random things like make mixtapes and then make magic brownies to go along with the mixtape for educational purposes. Like, I know a guy who has his same speech patterns and his same laugh and all this stuff, and then also will go off on how he can build if he could build a self-replicating drone, he could prove the multiverse, and then talking about how he gets his kids into building robots at home and all kinds of stuff. So, like, the tech geek version of music geek Eddie.
He is probably the closest thing to a likable character in the film. I could see, and you're right, he doesn't have nearly enough screen time. And when he is there, he has some, you know, interesting points to make, but for the most part, he's just kind of, you know, another character in this already kind of bloated movie. And it's not that long. It's only about a 90-minute film.
But it was the 90s. Movies were 90 minutes then.
But I felt every minute of it. Even watching it now, like trying to look at it through the lens of 1995, man, it's tough. And critics at the time agreed with me. That this movie was not good.
Oh, I know that they did. They were wrong too.
The movie was trashed on pretty heavily and also flopped pretty hard at the box office, bringing in only $303,000 total cum in the U.S. So
yeah, I did not know that the movie existed until I was in high school, I think, and I saw it at the record store at movie gallery, and I was like, oh hey, that's the girl from That Thing You Do, and then like it has a little sticker on the front saying what's on the soundtrack, and I was like, oh, and it's got Gin Blossoms on the soundtrack. But then I didn't rent it. I didn't ever see it till I was in my 20s, and it came on HBO one day. I was like, okay, cool, I'll watch this movie now.
And that is exactly what this movie is to me. It was a soundtrack and a pretty good one, and then a movie written to accompany a soundtrack.
I can give you that, and I can see, it's like I was saying, I can see why people don't like it. I still love it, but I can see why it's not everyone's cup of tea. But I would even say it's more than just a soundtrack, because it's also just a bunch of, like, even if you accept the premise that the movie and the story isn't good, some of the quotes are great.
Yeah, this is the movie that gave us the phrase, damn the man, save the empire.
Damn the man, save the empire. Which I still say that David Sunday and I should start a podcast of 90s music and call it Sam the Man, Dave the Empire.
Yeah. you can run.
I still say that's literally the first time I've ever said that out loud, but it works because of our names.
It works for the names. And you could examine 90s movie soundtracks.
Yeah.
This one would be
a good
one.
We do that here, though. Yeah.
This one would be a good one, because even though there's a lot of stuff missing from the soundtrack that should be there, this is the movie that made the Gin Blossoms' Till I Hear It From You a major hit for them.
Yes, and it's a great song.
It really is. That is, it's used twice in the movie. The first time you meet Liv Tyler's character, and at the end.
When they're all dancing on the.
Yeah, just before the dance party on the roof.
That's right, just before the guest, because the dance party on the roof is a different song. It's when Corey and AJ have their unearned, and I'll give you this, their totally unearned get-together at the end. I think a much better ending for their arc would have been that they just get back to being friends and Corey gets over himself. I mean, AJ gets over himself. Yeah.
Everybody in this movie is dumb. There is not one smart character in this film.
I think Jane is smart. She does quit her job in the middle of some town she doesn't live in. But
and she goes on to basically try and hook up with the record store manager.
Yep.
And he's even I wanted him to be the smart one. You know, he's the guy who's got all this experience and everything, and he even tells you a little bit about his like failed relationships at one point, just kind of in offhand comments. Even one where his ex-girlfriend asked him to leave at gunpoint. I was like,
yep,
sure know how to pick him there, buddy. But even he is just remarkably stupid. And there's this one moment where he's just finally had it with Lucas. And I don't know if it's just me, but whenever I look at this guy, he looks like a mafioso to me.
I guess he looks to me like a guy who's trying to look like a mafioso.
I kind of get that impression from him, probably because of other things that he's been in.
Oh, yeah.
And when he finally drags Lucas back to the office to beat the shit out of him, I was like, Lucas is not coming out of here alive. But he is about to lose his life right here, and it's going to be glorious. But then he comes out with barely a mark on him, and I'm like, so what really happened in there that you just kind of like push him around a little bit?
Maybe he spanked him.
That's entirely possible. Now, a few pluses that I will give this movie is peak Renee Zellweger. This is the only time I think that she was probably really attractive.
She also gets one of the best lines when Deborah, played by Robin Tooney, comes back in with her head shaved. Then Renee Zellweger says, well, Sinead O'Rebellion, shock me with that deviant behavior.
Yes, that I will give her that one. And I'll give her the moment where she comes back with the apron on.
And, yes.
that's a pretty hot little moment. And also her...
And then her line there, welcome to Music Town.
Yes.
Service you.
That I was like, yeah, see, that's good. It's like a little good moment. And that's probably why I get so frustrated with this movie, because there will be moments like that where it's like, okay, I feel like we're about to start finding a groove, and then we go back into the ditch.
And there is a part of me that wants to see, because knowing that it was written to take place over a different amount of time sort of explains some of that away. Like, they throw in some of the random montages to act as transitions where the original transition may not have worked. Because I know there's a scene where AJ gets rejected by Corey, but then the very next scene, he's dancing with Debbie and acting like he's completely fine and over-sexually dancing with Debbie as a joke.
Yeah, there are a couple of moments.
Yeah, there's a lot of points like that where it just kind of goes from one thing to something unrelated. And I feel like, especially because so much of the dialogue is good, so many of the lines are good, that it was originally written as a much better movie, and there was probably a studio mandate that made it what it ended up being. That said, I still love it. Like, I'm not saying it's objectively good. I'm saying I love it.
Yeah, I've tried to get on board with this movie, and you would think I would, because I was a guy who liked Can't Hardly Wait back in the day. But, I mean, of course, my opinion shifted on that movie, watching it in a modern context.
And I guess I like this one in a way I never liked Can't Hardly Wait, because I never liked the house party trope in school movies also.
Sure.
This is really, I guess, objectively about the same in terms of quality. I still would say this has better dialogue and whatnot than Can't Hardly Wait did. But
about the same.
This, you know, a bunch of people in a record store, a bunch of basically losers in a record store, is just more, it seems like more the atmosphere I'd want to be in.
The concept.
And it's definitely an atmosphere more fun to watch.
The concept is great. The idea of a day in the life of record store employees back when that was actually a thing. Because we've seen
on that note, yesterday, as of this recording, was National Record Store Day, so I hope everybody went out to their local record stores and got some good deals. I did not, but I did last year. Got James Taylor's Greatest Hits last year.
Well, see, that is a good thing to note, and that's apropos of our recording time, that
that's right.
Record Store Day was just recently. And it's, I mean, like I said, the concept is really good. We just see it done way better in other movies, like High Fidelity in 2000, that has a similar feel, but is, like, smartly written. Whereas
of course, it's also based on a smartly written book.
Very true. This, I can't make any real defense of this movie's quality in terms of, like, because I disagree on the dialogue. I think the dialogue is pretty terrible. And I think that the...
You can be wrong. It's okay.
Yeah, I can be right, too. And I am right about this because the dialogue here is terrible. It's not well written. It's not even well delivered. There's a point where, like, Mark is high off his ass. And this is the part of the movie where I just really want to punch him in the face when he gets, like... It's like he's starting to deliver a monologue.
I see those scenes as the monologue scenes as being almost like a Greek chorus, because Lucas acts as a narrator in the beginning. Mark acts as the narrator introducing Rex Manning Day. That's kind of a thing that's to me is a stylistic choice.
Maybe, but it also feels like an inside joke that nobody but the filmmakers are in on. And that's the real problem, is that to me it feels like the audience wasn't included really in this Rex Manning joke, because they start in on it pretty, like, randomly, no real build to it. There's even a point when Mark is singing the song right at the beginning of the film before we've ever heard the song, and I just found that frustrating, because I was like, is this kid, like, really just blitzed out of his mind right now? What is he even saying? It's too much for me, especially for characters who have done nothing to endear themselves to me. And then AJ kind of comes close at one point, because he actually does have a moment where he calls out Lucas on his bullshit, because Lucas is doing this pseudo-philosophical thing, which is pretentious as hell. And AJ is the only one to say, you weren't like this yesterday. What? And now all of a sudden, here's the quote that really just, like, derails AJ for me. You're acting like the Chinese guy from The Karate Kid. And I mean, that's a whole, so hard.
That's a whole, like, thing on its own. Because there's that line, that, like, the racism, there's the homophobia throughout a lot of things. I will give you that. Like, because every time I watch this, I notice a little bit more where it's like, oh, well, okay then.
Yeah, it's
I mean, I understand that those attitudes were more prevalent in the 90s, but it doesn't make them right. People knew that they were wrong then, and they still did them. They just knew that they could get away with it then.
Yeah, and that is a thing about the mid-90s and 90s in general. Hell, even into the early 2000s. I watched a couple episodes of Friends recently from, like, 2002, 2003, like season 9, season 10. And even then, there are, like, some pretty heavy homophobic jokes.
Oh, I mean,
being played in there.
If you watch Friends, really just about, yeah, there's homophobic humor all throughout that show. Like, every reference...
Very much
so. For a show that talked about, that pretended it was so progressive, really was not.
Yeah, it has a lot of drawbacks. It may have been progressive in some areas, but there's one that it really wasn't. And, I mean, that's just going to be a thing, I think, whenever we talk about 90s comedies, is that that's going to be a source of a lot of the jokes, unfortunately. And this movie is no exception to that. This movie does... one other thing that I think is really off, even by 90s standards, and that's its handling of the subject of suicide. That really did not work for me at all the first time I saw it, and even now it's even worse, because it's like, it's very ham-fistedly handled. And, I mean, they open the conversation about it in a probably the only real way that you could. But then it's the, how do we help our friend feel better? And, oh, let's throw her a fake funeral. And it's like, man, where are people's heads at right now? I had real trouble reconciling some of this. So I had to kind of, like, really back away from the movie at that point. Like, wow, this is cringy. Like, it kind of makes you feel a little dirty watching it, to me.
All right, I'll give you that. And I guess I look past a lot of that. I look past a lot more than I should probably with this movie, because I did see it so much earlier too.
Yeah, and like I said from the start, this movie came out at a time when this kind of movie was not a thing.
Yeah,
there were no other movies like it. in 1995 because the John Hughes copycat movies that were going to be coming up like a year later, starting with She's All That, that none of that had happened yet. There wasn't really much of a hint of it. So this was a movie that was trying something without a template. So yeah, you try to give them a little leeway. And then for kids at the time, or even slightly before and slightly after, who worked in retail, especially in retail very similar to what Empire Records is, I think it spoke to that generation of kids in a way that it
also came in on the tail end of grunge. Yeah. And the dirty aesthetic lends itself to that.
It does.
I like.
Yeah, it's like it's that transitional movie, like where the grunge days are coming to an end, and this is that movie that's kind of stuck in. It's got its feet in both worlds. Like it's got that dirty aesthetic going on, but there are also times whenever this movie looks kind of slick, like it's really polished and produced. So it's trying to be both, and yet it's succeeding at being neither. At least from my point of view, that's how I viewed it. Now, there is one other part of this movie that is just so hard for me to wrap my mind around. And I'm the kind of guy that can suspend his disbelief to watch movies where like characters literally fly and have like superpowers and crazy shit and like, you know, monsters, aliens, whatnot, and have a great time. But there's a part in this movie where a kid comes into the record store with a gun and like starts discharging this thing, and you don't really see like mass panic, and the cops don't just bust in and like wind up taking this kid down, and even goes to so far as to say, oh, he loaded blanks into the gun, so there's really not that much they can do to him, before they haul him off to supposedly go to juvie. But then he's out less than like an hour later and right back at the record store. Mind blown. I was Seinfeld giffing out of this one right there. I was like, okay, that's enough. We're done here.
See, when I first saw this, I hated that character, Warren. He just seemed like...
He is the worst. He is one of the worst child actors ever. My God.
Well, the thing is, I wouldn't say that he's even necessarily a bad actor. Like, I know people just like him. Like, especially when I was that age, I knew people just like him. And I hated those people, too. And so, when I watch it now, like, because you kind of see, there's a character that you see the way that the outside world would see the main characters.
Yeah.
Because they do have that whole little thing, you know, Lucas is like, that he's a loser, and everybody's talking about how they're losers, and that Joe took them in, and I like the fact that you hate Warren so much, that you as the audience hate Warren so much, because then at the end when they decide to accept him, then it kind of shows that they are doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Because I don't like Warren. And the fact that I don't like him and they accept him, I'm saying the same thing over and over again. Yeah. Let's make a long episode.
Yeah. How about, you know, a kid referring to himself as Warren Beatty?
I mean, everybody makes, like, I'm pretty much over pretending that any adult knows what pop culture references any kid is going to make.
Yeah, like, I don't know, that one just made me...
Their entire YouTube supercuts of Riverdale characters referencing things that their parents wouldn't be old enough to know about.
Yeah, it's some weird stuff, right? Like, that one kind of tripped me out a little bit. Not that it's necessarily unheard of. I mean, it was 1995, but, you know...
Yeah, Warren Beatty was, like, because Bullworth came out, what, 3 years after that? He was still doing movies a lot.
Yeah, he was still very active in the 90s, and, I mean, he was still making hits, I'm sure. it was just one of those things. It's like, that's funny. This kid knows who Warren Beatty is. And yeah. But
also, on that same note, I remember reading a synopsis of the movie shortly after I saw it, and I guess it was written by a kid who saw it and did not get the joke and actually thought that his name was Warren.
Yeah, that's... I can kind of see how that might confuse somebody, because they continuously refer to him as Warren throughout the movie, because that's the only name that they give him. Even though at one point he does say, that's not my name, but we never actually find out what his real name was.
Yeah.
Now, I'll ask you this, because I think it's pretty clear that I don't have any favorite characters in this movie. Who was your favorite character? Like, who did you latch on to like then and now?
So then Lucas, now Eddie. Okay. There was, but I will give one also. At one point, I guess in my mid-20s, I was watching this with some people, and we watched some of the deleted scenes. There's actually a scene after Rex Manning gets kicked out where he runs into Burko in the back, and they actually have a moment. Now, considering that Rex Manning is an asshole and statutory rapist and whatnot, it's better not to put a humanizing scene for Rex Manning in there. But it's a really interesting scene because Burko actually just has his guitar with him, and Rex asks if he can see it, and he plays a riff, and then he hands it back to him and says, you know, they didn't even let me play the guitar on my last three albums. And Burko says, well, that'll never happen to me. And Rex says, see that it doesn't, and then leaves. It's just, and I don't know that that makes me like either character more. I feel like Burko might have been a likable character if they had given us more of him. Like, if we had seen more of who he was. But I like that interaction a lot. And I think I understand why it would have been cut, but maybe it would have fit in whatever the original vision for the movie was.
I think so, because we don't get much of him in the film. And he kind of comes out of nowhere as a, was it Debbie's boyfriend?
Yeah.
Yeah, Deborah's boyfriend. He's... Never would have thought that, but then again, like we alluded to earlier, you can't really tell who's interested in who exactly in this movie, because on the one hand, you'll have like AJ trying to confess his love to Corey, but then is like having a very suggestive dance with Deborah in the store just a few minutes later. It's kind of all over the place in that regard. And then, of course, Renee Zellweger's Gina hooks up with Rex Manning.
Also, that underwear, because she was guessing the color, that's not navy blue. That was royal blue.
Yes, that was definitely not navy blue, because he was like, huh. Okay. I was like, she's wrong.
That is something that I just feel like I'm taking crazy pills every time I watch the movie. I'm like, no, that is not navy blue.
It is not. It is certainly not. Like, whenever he drops his pants and it's like, huh, she was wrong. And, yeah, it's just another weird moment in the movie. But, I mean, I get why she would have used that, because clearly Corey would have told her at dinner or at lunch what color his underwear was. But that's another scene that I have trouble like figuring out just exactly what the filmmakers were going for. When
there's a scene, and because I've seen, I guess, an extended cut of the movie, and I didn't even realize it was an extended cut. I think might have been
an extended cut.
Oh yeah, and I think it might have been used to be on Netflix. I'm not sure. I don't know how it is that I saw this. But because the two things that I remember being different is at the beginning, when Lucas is about to leave to go to Atlantic City, a customer comes in and he's trying to get this customer out of the store. And then the second scene is there's an extended scene of Corey trying to seduce Rex Manning. And what he actually does, he doesn't just say rock and roll. He like unzips his pants and then he picks up the salad dressing and says, I hope you like the taste of blue cheese, and then acts like he's going to put salad dressing on his dick.
That's weird.
It's even more, oh, yeah, that's why she just ran away.
Yeah, it would probably have worked better if they'd have left that in, because the standard version that I've always seen of this movie, none of that's happening. It's just he unzips his pants and I guess is pulling his dick out. And when she just like grabs up all her stuff and runs off, I was like, in your mind, how did this go? Like you're trying to seduce a guy in the back of a record store. You've already stripped down. I'm not sure what you thought was going to happen next. I'm trying to like get into the teenage mindset. I guess if she is technically still a teenager, I mean we get it earlier in the movie that she's about to head off to Harvard.
Yeah, she's graduating high school.
I was like, I get the story that they set up there. Like she wants to seduce, you know, a guy that she's had a crush on since she was like super young. You know, the teenage fantasy and all. But then you get to this part where she seems like just repulsed by this instance, and I guess I was left as confused as Rex was.
And the first time I saw it, I was confused, and then I guess it was probably the second time I saw it. The second time that I watched it, then they had it was the whole scene. But then also, I think it actually after she runs away, then he's like. Then he puts the dressing down and just goes back to eating. Like he was doing it intentionally to try to get her to leave.
Oh, well, that's... You see, that could be an interesting twist on him. That would also humanize him a little bit more if he was trying to get her to go away.
Except then he turns around and has sex with...
Yeah, then they would have ruined it with the whole Gina thing.
Yeah.
And their confrontation later about Corey's drug abuse, which also kind of... comes out of nowhere, and
yeah.
Gina, everybody refers to her as this like really slutty loose character throughout the film, but the whole like Rex Manning thing is the only time that I ever really even thought of it as being a real thing. To me it seemed more like this is just a label that people have heaved upon you, but not an earned label.
Yeah.
And it seemed really shitty for them. So Gina kind of becomes a little bit of a sympathetic character in that regard to me.
I think Gina's one of the more sympathetic characters through most of the movie.
And I think that's fair. One character, there are several characters that I cannot muster 1 ounce of sympathy for. But Gina is actually one of the few that I'm like, you know what, I feel like she got handed kind of a raw deal here from a lot of the people around her and they should give her a break.
Yeah.
Is it just me or does Rex Manning actually kind of look like the guy who played Jonathan Kent on Smallville? Yeah, that's who I thought it was for the longest time. I was like, wait a minute, is John Schneider in this movie?
No.
And then it's totally not him. No, it's
a lot of the people in this movie you don't see in a whole lot else. Like Rory Cochran's in what's the 70s one? Days of Confused.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And Johnny Whitworth was in The Rainmaker.
He was also in one of the Ghost Rider movies.
Oh, I didn't. It must have been the one I didn't see. Ethan Embry was in quite a bit. But, like, Burgo and Eddie, I don't think I've ever seen in anything else. Warren, I don't think I've seen. Like, I thought that Warren was the football player in The Faculty, but he wasn't. It was just a guy that looks like him.
Yeah, very, very similar. Warren is in a few different like bigger name movies, though. He was in Black Hawk Down.
I haven't seen that in a long time, and everybody looks the same in that movie because it was shot in such a low saturation. It was just a bunch of white dudes in uniforms.
Well, that is fair. That's maybe the biggest name movie he was in after this. He was in that movie, Boys Don't Cry, if you remember that one, which is probably one that we may watch for this.
Yeah, we should.
Because that's a pretty heavy movie.
I've actually not seen it, but I knew that. I mean, I know the premise.
Yeah, it's pretty tough. It's a pretty tough watch, but yeah, he's in that. So yeah, there are several people who go on to have bigger careers from this movie. But I don't know if it's necessarily because of this movie, because it certainly was not well received.
No, it wasn't. And I mean, Anthony LaPaglia was already like on his way up. Debbie Mazur was already on her way up. Ethan Embry, I guess, kind of got kicked off by this one.
He was...
Because he did the National Lampoon Vegas Vacation, but that was after this, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was after this. So was Can't Hardly Wait. So his like stature as a teen star really was kind of reaching about its halfway point, I think, with this movie. And then he would go on to do more successful pictures and, of course, I think segue into television after that. I think that's what he's doing now is more TV stuff.
I saw him on when I used to watch ABC's Once Upon a Time. He was in a season of that.
I forgot about that.
It does not look the same anymore.
No, not at all. He looks very different.
Very different. Like, you kind of see the eyes. Once I saw his name in the credits, then I started looking for him.
He does get one of my one of the scenes I think is really funny in this movie. When he's eating what we presume were pot brownies, but clearly there's more in there than just pot, because he has a full-on hallucination that he is joining the
joining Gwar.
Shock rock
you
band.
You love Gwar. Gwar. Why don't you join the band?
You play a mean guitar. It's too bad you gotta die. And then he gets eaten by a puppet on stage.
And the way that he's just like giggling while he's watching it.
Yeah, he doesn't, like, at first it looks like he's about to freak out, but then he stops and just keeps eating the brownie and is like, no, this is actually pretty cool. Like, I'm being eaten on stage at a Gwar concert. Gwar, another band, like the actual band featured in the movie, not on the soundtrack.
Yep. Oh, yeah, well, I mean, I was about to say, we're about to have a whole conversation about songs that didn't make it to the soundtrack that are awesome, right?
Yes.
Because we had, yeah.
There's you could have two volumes, like, and this is going to prove my point, that this movie was a soundtrack before it was a movie, because there is a ton of music that is featured in the film that didn't make it onto the soundtrack. You could do, like, two or three volumes for this.
Romeo and Juliet by the Dire Straits. That's an amazing one. In the movie, not on the soundtrack. How by the Cranberries is featured twice in the movie. Amazing song, not on the soundtrack. Plowed by Sponge is featured very heavily in the movie. Amazing song, not on the soundtrack. What else? Like this, I'm looking at a list. Isn't it? Oh yeah, Video Killed the Radio Star.
Yeah, that's a...
not in the movie. I mean, not in the soundtrack, but it's in the movie. Like there's some great music in this movie, and there is like original music for the movie or original recordings of existing songs for the movie that still didn't get put in the soundtrack. And how?
Yeah.
God damn it. How?
Yeah. That one just like blows my mind that it would have been left out. Even the songs that the number one though that should have been in there is the movie that was, or the song that was made for the movie.
Say no more.
Yeah, the Rex Manning song, the whole thing that like gets played over and over throughout the movie is nowhere to be found on the soundtrack in any version by anyone. I mean, they even feature, at least you get a version of Sugar High in the on the soundtrack. But it doesn't have
doesn't feature Renee Zellweger.
No, only the version in the movie features Renee Zellweger. So those would be the major ones. And it's also kind of interesting that If You Want Blood, You've Got It by AC/DC is not featured, because that actually gets a pretty prominent scene in the film when who is it that goes back to play his drums? Joe. He goes back to play his drum set to work out some frustrations in the day, and that's the song he's playing drums to while like Lucas, AJ, and Warren all do their own little like lip sync performances of it. And that's kind of a nice scene in the movie to me. I like little stuff like that, but again, not featured on the soundtrack. But as we alluded to before, or as we said before, Till I Hear It From You by the Gin Blossoms was featured on the soundtrack. Major hit for them. And there are a few other songs on that soundtrack that I like. I think that the Cranberry song that did make it on there is pretty good.
Yeah. I just really love the one that didn't make it on there.
Oh, I agree with you. I think that that's a better song. And I like Circle of Friends from Better Than Ezra. I think that that's a pretty good tune. But yeah, overall...
Yeah, Crazy Life by Toe the Wet Sprocket's good. Yeah. I always forget it's in the movie until it shows up.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, oh, yeah, it's in there.
there's so much driven in the plot, or the whole movie really does feel like it's driven by the music that's played in it, and it's a good cross-section of what people were listening to right around 1995.
Yeah.
Or where they were kind of headed, I guess. So in that way, maybe the movie's
Sort of alternative time.
Yeah, it was like alternative rock music was still a thing. Like, you could hear little bits of, like, maybe where the metal scene might be headed a little bit later down the road. But it was definitely the movie that was starting to steer away from, like, the grunge sound. Not like movies like Reality Bites or Singles, you know, that were very, very heavily influenced by grunge culture. This movie was kind of the antithesis of that. It wanted to move away from it.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, still not a very good movie, because I don't feel like we get any time with these characters.
I say still a very good movie because it looks like it's fun to watch, and it looks like something to that I want to hang out. Like, it looks like something I want to hang out in and be a part of.
Yeah, like, hanging out there might be fun, but man, just a weird bunch of stuff happens in this movie that makes no sense. And that's really the movie's biggest drawback, is that whenever you are watching this expecting a coherent narrative, it doesn't really have one. It's just nonsense. And by the end, with them having a dance party on the roof after, you know, miraculously raising enough money to save the record store, of course they did. By that point, I feel like the movie has either beaten you into submission or you've stopped watching it. And
well, I guess I got beaten into submission because I'm like, all right, I like this.
Yeah, it's like if you're on board with it from the jump, it didn't really have to beat you into submission. You went willingly. Like, for people like me who aren't enjoying the movie, you'll get to that point and either you've just, you know, acquiesced to it, or you stopped watching long before you got to this point. But since we had to do, we were going to do this one for the podcast, I sat through this movie multiple times. I watched this movie. I'm committed.
Don't say that I never do anything for you.
I'm committed.
I got you to sit through a movie you hate. That was a very nice thing.
I feel like I did this for you. I think I did this for you there, buddy. I sat through this. I tortured myself for this one because that's how dedicated I am to the show. I sat through garbage for this, and that's exactly what
garbage is not on this soundtrack. Okay.
Yeah, their heyday wouldn't be for a little while. Or
yeah.
Not probably, like, I don't know, not that long after this, probably like a year later.
Yeah, it's around this time.
Yeah, like 96, 97, they would have been blowing up. So yeah, just a year later, garbage would be a thing.
Of course, you know, I mean, if we were writing a movie about the 90s, we would just mash all 90s things together, even though it was a 10-year decade like all decades.
Yeah.
We'd be like, oh yeah, people are listening to the new Nirvana album while drinking Surge. And I'm like, that doesn't happen.
Oh, that's a reference to another movie. But I think if we were to write a movie about the 90s, we would make it a musical very much in the vein of something like Across the Universe.
That's a good idea.
That's,
we should write that. Except we have to get rights to a bunch of songs, and I don't have money for that, do you?
Yeah. That's the part we're going to run into. At least in Across the Universe, they just had to, you know, focus on getting the rights to Beatles songs. When it comes to doing the kind of musical that I would want to do, it would require getting the rights to, like, hundreds of, like, 90 songs from several different groups and performers, and yeah, that's just not going to happen. But I digress. But maybe one day somebody's going to do that. I really hope they do, because movies like this tend to remind me just how rich the 90s were when it came to music for, like, movie soundtracks, just music in general. Like, there's so much to love about it. And even if you don't like the movie, like this one for me, I can go through all these songs and be like, my God, you remember how, like, just genius some of these performers were back in the day? And just how much enjoyment we got from some of this, like, just monumentally depressing music.
Oh, I know. Did you have, I know that you didn't like most of the dialogue. Are there any quotes that really stood out that you really liked, though?
Not especially, no. No. That's the thing. Like, most of the time, like, whenever I would get close to enjoying the movie, it would mostly be in scenes involving Joe, because it seemed like he's the guy who's trying to hold things together. And I do like one thing he says, though, to Gina after she has sex with Rex Manning. And he tells her to go home, and she asks, oh, well, am I fired? And he looks at her and says, have I fired anyone today? And I was like, that's a good point.
Yeah, if I fired anyone today, why would I start with you?
Yeah, it's like, why would I start with you over that? No, it was like, Lucas just, like, blew 9,000. He blew all the store's money from the day before, and he's still here. Like, that's, you know, you're not going to get fired over something like that. So I'm like, okay, you see, Joe is turning out to be a pretty decent human being, even if he's not the smartest human being. So in that was a moment where I think that's the closest I got to really emotionally invested in the movie, is Joe having that little quiet moment. And also I thought it was kind of funny with, AJ gluing quarters to the floor.
So when I was, in high school, somebody glued a quarter to the floor of the break room of our little non-traditional school building, and somebody else, like, nobody could get it up, so then somebody else actually cut it up with a knife, and then they restricted anyone from being in the break room.
Welp.
Yep. Can't have nice things.
I just figured this was AJ's, you know, subtle way of saying, how do you keep a moron busy for hours?
Yeah, and then it and works, because you see Warren's
<Yes. there. laughs> Who glued these quarters down? My God, he was really turning on the accent at times, too, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Like, to a fake degree. Like, you're, and I was like, come on, man, your accent's not that thick. Not really. You're a liar. But yeah, this is one of those that, now that I've watched it several times, there are a couple of moments that are not bad. Even, like, maybe one or two good ones, but they are surrounded by a poorly written and poorly realized film that actually has a pretty good concept at its heart. I get what the movie's trying to be at its heart, and maybe that's why it hit with the people that it really hits with, is because it's like, okay, we can get at your heart because you can see the concept, even if we're not fully executing that concept at all. And these kids watching this movie see something like, you know, AJ's version of love, like what he thinks love looks like.
But who in their early 20s doesn't think love looks like that?
Well, no, like, that's the thing. Like, that's who it's going to appeal to you there. That's why I'm saying that if you watch this movie as a kid, if you watch this movie when you're teens or even in your early 20s, it'll certainly hit with you, because that's probably the definition of love that you've been working from for a long time. But if you're like me and you don't see this movie until you're in your 30s, it's going to come across like bullshit. And that's really the problem, is that this movie is made for the young, and I guess for the young at heart, but for anyone else, like, if you're my age or older, even slightly younger, I can't lie, I'm in my late 30s now. So if you're watching the movie at that age, I'd almost guarantee it doesn't hit with you.
I mean, I'm in my mid-30s and it still hits with me, but it's because it hit with me when I was younger.
And it is.
Yep.
But if you experience the movie for the first time, I would guarantee you're not going to like it all that much. But you know what? I would love to hear from somebody who is, like, in their, like, late 20s, 30s, or whatever, who's never seen this movie. Sit down, watch it, and see if it hits with you, or if you think it's insane. And you can tell us about that on Twitter. You can hit me up at Russell_Sellers. And, Sam, where are they going to find you?
I am at Mr. Woodles on the tweets and the gram. I'm not on Snapchat because I don't get it.
Yep. See, that's where we draw the line. Snapchat. Not doing it. I don't care.
My wife signed up. I think I probably said this in our last episode. My wife signed up, and she was like, I can't figure out exactly what the point of this thing even is. I was like, yeah, I don't know. I'm not going to try then.
It was described to me at one time as a platform for kids to send naked pictures to each other.
That's disturbing.
Yeah,
kids that's... shouldn't be naked. They should be born fully clothed, I've decided.
Yeah, that was like, okay, so why does this exist? How does this still exist? And it seems...
Oh, but I think the new one, though, is TikTok. That's the one where you lip-sync to a song.
Huh?
That's an app. That's see ads for it before the dumb little games that I play. Yeah.
Okay.
Because I play dumb games on my phone sometimes while I'm watching TV, because I need multiple stimulants going on in my brain at once. So there's ads for little thing. Yeah, apparently that's the same thing, though. It turned into a bunch of predators got on there. So
that's the problem with all these apps. They all get hijacked by terrible people. And that's exactly what happened to Snapchat, Twitter, Facebook, all of it. I mean, social media has just become a den of vipers that we should all probably just run from. But hey, while you're at it, find us on Twitter.
Find us on Twitter. We joke on Twitter. I mostly make political humor, when I say humor, I just retweet people that are smarter than me on politics, and I make really dumb jokes, and I talk with my friends Russell and other Place to Be Nation compatriots.
Well, you see, that's what we do. That's what Twitter's good for. At least we...
Instagram I rarely post, but it's mostly food or pictures of my dog and cats.
And they are adorable, by the way. So
I know they are.
My
dog is right here with me.
See, Eddie is adorable. He should get more. He should get all the likes. Everybody should just go find pictures of Eddie.
Yeah, everybody go find pictures of Eddie. Go to my Instagram at Mr. Woodles. Click through. Find pictures of my dog. Like them.
And surprisingly delicious-looking gluten-free food.
Yes.
That is a thing that also happens, and you know what? I've eaten dinner with you and Reedy on many occasions, and it usually is pretty good.
I mean, let's be real. I'm a damn good cook.
That's true. I'm not going to dispute it. It's good. It's real good. Which reminds me, I'm due for a trip to Atlanta soon, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
And with that, it's not just us on the old Place to Be Nation. There are a lot of people out here making shows and doing good things, doing their thing. And this past week, it was another busy week for the old Pop Feed, because we had Steve and Kelly back on a new episode of Songs with Friends. They welcomed Jason Sherman on to talk some Bush, which Bush is, well, clearly the band. But
yes.
I'm sure that maybe there was some old W and HW talk in there, too, maybe. I don't know. Maybe they're talking about the shrubberies, too. Who knows? Greg and Nick came back with there are a couple of episodes of Hard Traveling Fanboys you need to check out right now, because they're in the middle of Shazam month, taking a look at the popular Charlton Comics and DC Comics character, who just had his movie come out. In fact, their most recent episode was a full-length review of Shazam.
It's a spoiler-free review, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It is spoiler-free.
I've still not made it down to see that one.
You definitely need to. It was ringing endorsements all the way around there, but they go deep on some of the influences that clearly helped to steer the movie. We also have Andrew and Adam are back breaking down where the non-NBA playoff teams are headed in the newest NBA team podcast. And of course, I'm on a different podcast from this one as well, on the old Marvel Age. I joined the rest of the Sarcastic Four, Tim Capel, Todd Weber, and Nick Duke, as we took a look at the first half of 1970. We got the second half of that coming really soon, as well as a look at a little more in-depth look at 1970 Part 1, as I joined Ben Morse for Marvel Age Masterclass. Jenny and Tim had another episode of Talking Pop where they had a longtime Place to Be Nation staple Glenn Butler on. They had him up in the hot and high seat for this month. We also had the second annual Sassies over on Geek and Sassy. Jenny and Miranda broke down all of pop culture for 2018. They had to get in on this award season thing. That's what they do. And I got a ballot in time to get counted, and happy to say that a few of my favorites did manage to win.
Very nice.
And a few of them were completely shut out, but yeah, go figure. But we've got another new contest coming up that we want to tell people about, because I think you can still get in on this. It's being held over on the Looking Forward, Looking Back show. They're going to be doing a summer movie wager based on how well you think you can predict how this summer's movie releases will do at the domestic box office. What you do is you pick the top 10 movies in order of how you think they will finish at the domestic box office, and then also include three wild card picks as which movies you think will, you know, do surprisingly well. And also, just for fun, pick out the movie you think will bomb the hardest. And you can send those picks to lflbpop@gmail.com. That's basically an abbreviation of Looking Forward, Looking Back, pop@gmail.com, by Monday, April 22nd. Any movie that is released on or after April 26th is eligible, with the tally ending on Labor Day, which is September 2nd. The winner of the contest gets to be on a future episode of Laugh In Theater and pick the comedy movie of their choosing to talk about with host Andy Atherton. And, of course, can't forget about the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed. Nate Milton and his crew are back to break down WrestleMania 35 on a special edition of Chain Reaction. It was a great show, so I hope everybody goes and checks that one out. Chris and Evan are here with the WrestleMania 35 reaction show, which is more of a live watch of it. JT and Chad are back with a new Wrestling Warzone. They're finishing off 1995 with a discussion about Starrcade, and we continue to dip into the Where the Big Boys Play Vault as Chad and Parv take a look at Starrcade 1987. And finally, you have Nick and Greg, the hard-traveling fanboys, but no, not here. This is their What If Pod Blast series. This is their second episode as they examine a world where CM Punk doesn't leave WWE in 2014. And also, you can check all of this out and more at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. And with that, I think we've covered everybody. I want to give special shouts to another show that just made its triumphant return on the pop feed that I completely forgot to mention before, and that is Conversation Comics with host Todd Weber, joined by Tim Capel. They're taking a look at the Dark Phoenix saga from X-Men, which is a tremendous time that I can't wait to double dip on when we get to it in the Marvel Age podcast. But go listen to them as they're continuing to break down that wonderful Chris Claremont X-Men run. And beyond that, I think that's it for all the other shows we wanted to talk about. But it's time to talk about what we're going to do next time, Sam.
Well, you know what they say about May the 4th.
It should be with you.
It should be with you, or something like that. Uh-huh. Actually, May the 4th was my first date with my wife.
Really? Y'all went out, your first date with your wife was on Star Wars Day?
Yes.
My God, and I never knew this?
I guess you did. I thought you did.
I did not know this. That is a hell of a thing.
Because we dated a few years ago and then lost touch and then got back together and then like reconnected and started dating. The first time, like from way back, because I actually, because everybody, we were all in, or you weren't there, that's right. Yeah, we were in Columbus for Iron Man 3.
Yeah.
But I didn't see Iron Man 3. I drove to Atlanta to go to take this girl out on a date instead, and then later I married her.
Well, by God, and we didn't have a Star Wars theme wedding. This is going to be the second time that there's not been a Star Wars theme wedding, and yet it's would have been appropriate, because a couple of friends of mine that I'm going to give a shout out who've never been mentioned on the shows before, my friends Rachel and Dan are going to be getting married on Star Wars Day on 4th this year.
And they're not doing a Star Wars wedding?
While it is not Star Wars themed, I have been told that there will be retractable lightsabers for us to use at the reception.
Nice. Anyway, speaking of Star Wars, the Venn diagram of Star Wars movies and movies released in the 90s narrows it down to one. And it's one that some people are just not going to want to hear about. But I think it's going to be a fun episode anyway.
Yeah, we're going to... I think we'll probably be...
Misa going to talk in this voice.
And we lost the last remaining listeners of this show. They're all gone now. The theater is clear.
Fair enough.
Yep, we are going to take a look at the 1999, I'm going to use this term loosely, classic Star Wars Episode One: The Phantom Menace, directed by Star Wars creator George Lucas.
Starring Jake Lloyd. Yeah. I feel bad, honestly, because all child actors are bad. He just happened to be the one in the movie that pissed off the group of people most likely to harass him for the rest of his life.
It's a rough time. It was a rough time to be a kid, to be a child actor, 1999, and it's a bad time. It's a bad look. But does the movie have redeeming qualities? Is there something that we're going to find to really enjoy about this film? Are we going to come together in our like mutual just distaste for this movie and the pretty much the whole of the prequel trilogy? I think. We'll find out.
I mean, there's a whole... The thing is, people's feelings on the prequels are more than just good versus bad. There's a spectrum.
There is. And as with all things, there is nuance, even within the prequel trilogy. It may not be held in high regard, but there are good things to be found within it, maybe even in Episode One.
And there are good things to be said even about the things that are not good to be found.
True.
And that's why we podcast.
That is exactly it. That is absolutely true. And we will get to Star Wars Episode One: The Phantom Menace on our very next episode. We hope you guys will come back for that one. Hopefully you don't hate me too much for my dislike of Empire Records. Sorry to all you folks out there that I offended with my taste. But not really. But next time we will probably be saying a lot of the very opinions that other people share about that particular film. But until then, you guys keep on enjoying this wonderful trek through the 90s, and we will see you then.
Peace out.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. The Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation Pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well, by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth search projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture.